Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Gunmen in Iraq abducted 6 Egyptian workers today, the latest in a string of kidnappings. It comes amid the drama surrounding British hostage Kenneth Bigley. Bigley was taken last week with 2 Americans. They were both beheaded. Bigley is thought to still be alive, and this week was shown on a videotape begging authorities to meet his kidnappers' demands that 2 Iraqi prisoners be freed.
I need you to help me, Mr. Blair, because you are the only person now on God's earth that I can speak to. Please, please help me see my wife who cannot go on without me.
Right after that videotape was released, Bigley's mother, wife, and son made their own appeals. Joe Riley is a columnist for the Liverpool Echo. The Bigley family, many of them are from that area. Joe, in the videotape released this week, he spoke directly to the people of Liverpool. He said to them, "You are a very special people. You are people who can open your mouths and speak and say enough is enough." What's been the response in that city?
Well, although it's a large city by British standards and the area takes in 2.2 million people, it is a very close community. It's got Irish, Scottish and Welsh roots, and the sense of family and belonging is very strong. So he would recognise that, coming from this area, that in fact when one person from Liverpool is in trouble, we feel that it is impinges on everyone in the city. It's a very close community.
Joe, what are people saying? I know they're calling talk radio, they're writing to your paper. What are they saying?
I think their feelings and their very personal messages, which are done in the first person, written by people saying, my prayers for you to the family. They feel that they have identified through this individual. They feel they know the people involved in this conflict. Sometimes a really dangerous, unpleasant situation like this is told even more dramatically through the tale of an individual than it is in cases of mass carnage or destruction, where although the grief may be many times greater, the identity with an individual is sometimes stronger.
Kenneth Bigley's 86-year-old mother made an appeal on television as well and then was hospitalized. It sounds as if they're getting to know the whole family.
Well, I must say I've been involved in journalism here for 37 years and very few stories have got to me personally like this. As you know, as a journalist yourself, we're dealing all the time, every day, as part of our lives with very often the unpleasant things of life. But I think this has got to the hearts of all the people here, and even to the people who are used to dealing with these situations have felt particularly grieved by it.
I know that your paper ran a double-page response. Members of the 441,000-strong population signed on and offered words of support. But what's happening across the rest of the country, and how is Tony Blair responding to this huge support for Mr. Bigley?
Well, there are two issues, really. Tony Blair and our Foreign Secretary Jack Straw, by themselves, are rendered rather powerless by the situation, because, in fact, it is an issue to be decided by the coalition with the United States and also by the incoming Iraqi administration. But the point is that it will have a political consequence, because this is the inevitable result, I have to say. I don't know what the perception is in America, but let me assure you the British people did not want this war, despite the fact that Mr. Blair attached himself to your president's coattails, did not want this war, and this is the inevitable result of being involved in that war. And we have been waiting in this country for either a mass outrage, which we have been warned is still possible. It just so happens, ironically, that the result has come in the no less powerful story of the plight of an individual.
We also read reports that the British Foreign Office is handing out leaflets in Baghdad to somehow try to urge Iraqis to help in finding Kenneth Bigley. That's highly unusual.
I think what's happened there is, of course, you do realise that the main leader of the group concerned with Mr. Bigley's kidnapping and with the unfortunate deaths of two of your fellow citizens is led by a Jordanian group, and therefore the Iraqi people themselves are not necessarily aligned to this particular outrage, and therefore it may be perceived that they can be of some use in seeking a solution. But of course it could equally inflame the situation if search parties literally go out to try and trace these people.
Joe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joe Riley, columnist for the Liverpool Echo. Well, President Bush's handling of the war in Iraq and the advice he received from his inner circle to launch that war may be important if Bush shapes a future cabinet. With 39 days and counting until the general election, whispers of cabinet-level resignations in a second Bush administration are becoming shouts. And there's also talk of what a Kerry cabinet would look like. A Wall Street Journal NBC News poll this week shows a majority of voters want the president to make major changes in a new term. So will Donald Rumsfeld, an architect of the Iraq War, go? And what about a Kerry cabinet that includes Bill Clinton? Here to talk about building a presidential cabinet are two presidential scholars. Shirley Ann Warshaw is professor of political science at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania. Welcome, Shirley Ann.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Thomas Mann, senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Hi, Tom.
Happy to be with you.
And Tom, let's start with you. It's said that, you know, many of the recent op-ed pieces in the nation's major newspapers are actually, you know, potential cabinet candidates auditioning. But is this the kind of thing that people in Washington really want to talk about openly?
Well, some people do. They love to gossip and speculate about who might populate a second Bush term cabinet or a Kerry cabinet.
Which we're about to do, by the way.
Interestingly, perhaps the most key appointments are ones not being discussed.
We're going to talk about that in a second. But Shirley Ann, I guess our understanding is that people can't really appear to want these jobs too badly.
Sure, sure. They want to say that they're supporting the campaign and they're supporting the candidate and there's nothing in it for any individual or them personally. Mm. But in fact, many people do want a cabinet position and are eagerly campaigning on the inside, and you correctly say not publicly.
Well, Tom Mann, let's talk first about a second Bush administration. You raised the question of the people who are making policy right now. Who do we know is definitely leaving? Everyone says Colin Powell will be the first out the door.
I think that's almost certainly the case, along with his deputy, Richard Armitage. I think it's fair to say that they've been good soldiers, but have, for the most part, been on the losing side of the critical policy battles, especially with respect to Iraq. So if Bush is reelected, we will see a new Secretary of State.
Well, Shirley Ann, the high on that list is former Senator John Danforth,
right.
Now the U.S. Ambassador to
right.
the U.N. But looking, swinging over to defense, will Donald Rumsfeld be able to stay?
Oh, good question. I think that's very much up in the air right now. I think he's certainly after the prison problems in Iraq, he's had his share of problems. But I think he feels that there's a mission there. And whether or not he wants to abandon or leave in the middle of the war in Iraq after he's advocated his position so strongly, I don't know that he would want to give that up before he's finished it.
Tom, let's look at the president's economic team. That's where there was already a firing. He fired Treasury Secretary John O'Neill when O'Neill questioned tax cuts. What names are floating here? And more important, what are the statements that the president has to make with those names?
Listen, the economic obstacles facing a second Bush term are enormous. Huge budget deficits, yet an aggressive policy agenda that includes partial privatization of Social Security, making permanent tax cuts, tax reform, none of which have a very high probability of actually being adopted. So, frankly, I think the lead players on economic policy in a second Bush term face formidable challenges, and I don't know who's rushing to take those jobs.
Tom, let me add something to that this administration has a serious deficit problem. are we likely to get a Wall Street economist into the administration, or Wall Street person in, or even an economist in, and Secretary of Treasury? And I would doubt it. And I think one of the big questions is then what kind of person is likely to lead Treasury? And I think Tom's right. They're probably likely to move somebody over from the White House.
Hmm. Well, it's said that National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice could have any job she wants. She might move over to defense if Donald Rumsfeld has to leave. But, Shirley-Ann, I want to ask you, just overall, I'm thinking also of Justice and John Ashcroft.
Sure.
Will the second Bush administration cabinet, if there is one, be ideologically the same as the first one?
I think, well, first of all, let me just go back a step if I could. That President Clinton had a very diverse cabinet. He had campaigned on having a cabinet, and he used the phrase, that looks like America. And that when President Bush came into office, he, too, wanted to mirror a cabinet that looked like America. So the first question is, will the cabinet continue to have the kind of diversity it had in the first administration if President Bush is reelected? And I would doubt that. What I think you'll see is larger numbers of conservative white men, the kinds of people, the Ralph Reeds, that supported this administration.
Hmm. We want to move to the Kerry administration, if there is one, and will he bring Republicans onto his cabinet?
I think almost certainly. Kerry understands the formidable obstacles he will face if elected president, with one or both houses of Congress and in Republican hands. He's going to have to try to change the dynamic on Capitol Hill, and one of the ways of trying to do that is to bring some prominent Republicans into his administration. There are a number of possibilities here, and I think, say, appointing Senator Richard Lugar, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, as Secretary of State, would be a very smart move on Kerry's part.
I'm not sure that I agree with that, Tom, that the history of bringing other party cabinet officials in has not been strong. And if we look back, for instance, at Bill Cohen in the second Clinton administration, Bill Cohen, a moderate Republican from Maine who President Clinton brings over to build these strong executive legislative relations, really lost the battle in the White House and clearly was outgunned by Madeleine Albright in the second term. The politicization of the White House staff and the need to control policy around political aims tends to moderate the effort to have a cabinet officer that is of the other political party.
And here are some of the names that are being thrown out for a possible Kerry cabinet. Former New Jersey Governor Thomas Kane. He was the Republican chair of the 9/11 Commission for Homeland Security. John McCain's name is always floating around. And we should also say that Kerry has been said to be looking at Richard Gephardt for Labor, Jamie Gorelick, who's also on the 9/11 Commission for Justice, and Max Cleland for Veterans Affairs. You know what we're going to do? We're going to take a break now. And when we come back, we want to ask both of you, first of all, that big name that's been floating around, Bill Clinton, should he surface in the cabinet? And should candidates be required to name these cabinet appointees before the election, while they campaign? We're talking with two presidential scholars, Thomas Mann of the Brookings Institution and Shirley-Ann Warshaw of Gettysburg College. We'll be right back with more of Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've been talking about who might be in the next U.S. president's cabinet. On the line is Shirley-Ann Warshaw, professor of political science at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania. Hi again, Shirley-Ann.
Hi, Robin.
And we also have Thomas Mann, senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Not the author, right, Tom?
Unfortunately, not that author.
Welcome to you both. Now, earlier, I spoke with Dal LaMagna, founder of the Progressive Government Institute. Now, he and his organization are in favor of cabinets being named during the election process. In fact, he has a website where people can nominate other people or themselves. So I asked him, what's wrong with the process as it is?
Well, the world has evolved to a point where it's so complex for us Americans to think that one person, a man or a woman, could run this country alone. is ludicrous. We believe at the Progressive Government Institute that the election should be framed around the cabinet. I mean, who's going to be the administration? And if you're not going to name the 20 members of your cabinet, let's hear about who might be your Secretary of Defense or State or your Attorney General.
But, Dal, would the electorate know enough about these nominees? You know, it's said that they have a hard enough time figuring out what the president's policies are. But say, for instance, would the electorate have known that Donald Rumsfeld would have Paul Wolfowitz, one of the main architects of the Iraq War, as his second, and would have known what a nomination of Donald Rumsfeld would have meant?
No, they wouldn't have. In fact, you know, before we set up our website, which is progressivegovernment.org, most of Americans, in fact, most people, didn't know how the administration looked. And if people go to that website, they can click their way through the entire government. We have 2,500 of these appointees up. And the process that we're doing is we're saying, hey, you know, who do you think should be in the new administration? Say it's a Kerry administration. And once a person is nominated, our staff then puts up their bio and their who they are. You know, you take Secretary of Homeland Security and, you know, go there and boom, there's Gary Hart. My personal favorite of all of them would be to have President Clinton be our Secretary of State.
Yeah. Dal, how hopeful are you that this might come to be, that the cabinet might be a part of the election process?
The odds of this happening are pretty slim. But I think, you know, with Kerry locked in this trap of having to talk all the time about the Iraqi war, it really would be an opportunity for him if he would start to name some cabinet members. Remember the rumors that surfaced 2 or 3 days before the election and Bush election, the original election, when they were talking about Colin Powell possibly being the Secretary of State. I think that helped Bush a lot, and I think it would be wise for Kerry. One, it would show that he's a leader and that he's bringing people in, who are these people, and that he's not trying to do this alone.
That's Dal Amanya of the Progressive Government Institute. We'll tell you later how you can get to his website, but right now we've got Shirley Ann Warshaw of Gettysburg College, Tom Mann of the Brookings Institution. And Tom, your thoughts on candidates naming the cabinet members during the campaign?
I'm skeptical on a couple of grounds. In the U.S. system, frankly, the cabinet as an entity is not particularly important. It doesn't exist as a policy-making body as it does in a parliamentary system. This focus on cabinet members elevates the importance of the cabinet over the White House staff and over the key informal advisors.
But, Tom, I'm sorry to interrupt, but and turning to Shirley Ann, some people would say that this cabinet in particular has been very important, and cabinets are important in wartime. And U.S. News and World Report has reported in its Washington Whispers column that President Bush might announce a new cabinet, including ex-Mayor Rudy Giuliani as Attorney General, Senator John McCain as Defense Secretary.
I think it's extremely unlikely. A second problem here is that the American public has difficulty focusing on more than two or three issues to start with. So you don't want to dilute the pot here in the campaign and add more issues for them to absorb. And certainly with 15 cabinet officers, that's 15 separate people that could affect the decision-making process. If President Bush or Senator Kerry were to name two or three people that seem out of sync with their line of thinking or out of sync at all, it really could carry just the number of votes to upset the election. So they're very skeptical about naming anyone.
But Tom, I want to get back to you.
Let me get back.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just add one thing about, for instance, there's no chance at all that President Bush is going to suggest that Mayor Giuliani. He is pro-choice. This is a very pro-life cabinet. Everyone in the cabinet is pro-life, and that would completely upset the conservative base. And this administration is working very hard, especially in states such as I'm in Pennsylvania, to motivate the conservative base to vote.
Tom, real quick, your thoughts on a Bill Clinton Secretary of State in a Kerry administration?
He's just too big robust a political figure. Better to use him as occasionally former presidents have been used to help deal with difficult problems, say, in the Middle East and elsewhere.
An envoy. And Tom, I just want to get back to your thought. Do you really think that cabinets really aren't that important to people?
I really do. Individual cabinet members can play an important role, but it's hard ahead of time to say where. The direction in policy making in this White House has clearly come from within, from Vice President Cheney, key advisors. And frankly, I think all the emphasis on the cabinet is distracting because it gets in the way of the public's task of really trying to figure out what the stakes are, what the choices are.
Well, I hope it wasn't too distracting for our listeners today. I found it illuminating to hear from both of you. Thank you both.
Our pleasure.
Enjoyed it. Bye-bye.
Bye. Tom Mann, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and Shirley Ann Warshaw, Professor of Political Science at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania. We also spoke with Dal LaMagna. He's founder of the Progressive Government Institute. To go to his website, go to ours, here-now.org. Next time on Here and Now, President Bush says he has great hopes for democracy in Iraq and beyond in the Middle East. Well, we'll look at the possibility of the first election in a close U.S. ally in a long time, Saudi Arabia. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Explosions were heard today in the rebel-held city of Fallujah in Iraq. Witnesses say the blasts rocked the eastern side of the city. U.S. warplanes have targeted specific locations in Fallujah, trying to root out insurgents. This comes as Iraq's Prime Minister Iyad Alawi continues his visit to the U.S. Today he met with Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and laid a wreath at Arlington National Cemetery. Yesterday, Alawi addressed a joint session of Congress and said that the values of liberty and democracy are taking hold in his country.
We must not forget either the progress we are making or what is at stake in Iraq. We are fighting for freedom and democracy, ours and yours. Every day we strengthen the institutions that will protect our new democracy.
David Phillips is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. He joins us on the line. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And I want your thoughts on Mr. Alawi's speech yesterday before Congress and also his words before the American Press Corps. A lot of people were surprised that it was so positive, some would say naive sounding. Does Mr. Alawi seriously believe some of the things that he said, the picture that he painted?
He did himself great damage yesterday. In order to be effective in Iraq, he has to demonstrate some distance from the Bush administration. The closer he's seen to President Bush, the less legitimate he is in the eyes of Iraqis. By cuddling up to the president and appearing to be stumping for his campaign, Alawi did himself personally and the cause of freedom and democracy a huge disservice.
Well, and you know Mr. Alawi.
I do, yes.
And why do you think he would do this? I mean, some people suggested that, in fact, the speech sounded as if it were written by Bush administration officials.
And I asked if any administration officials reviewed the speech. I didn't get a straight answer on that, although I do know that Americans did edit it. My feeling is that Alawi lives in a bubble in the green zone. He rarely is able to travel around Iraq. The flow of information to him is extremely limited. it's dangerous when people start to believe their own propaganda. I think that's the case for Alawi. That's also the case for the president, who only gets rosy depictions of what's going on in Iraq.
Well, we understand, in fact, reading news reports, that Mr. Alawi lives in a compound. It takes about an hour to get through the security, the soldiers, to actually get to the home where he lives.
I mean, he's totally disassociated from what's happening around the country. The fact that he believes that events in Iraq are improving, when in fact all the evidence is to the contrary, just shows how removed he is from conditions of reality.
Removed, or was there some other reason for him to say those things?
Well, keep in mind that Dr. Alawi owes his job to the Bush administration. He was essentially appointed by U.S. officials. He spent his whole life struggling against Saddam and against the Ba'ath Party, and he wants to have a future life in politics. He is entirely dependent upon U.S. support now and in the future, so it's entirely predictable that he would try to wrap himself in Bush's blanket.
With what you know of Mr. Alawi, do you think that he will remain the leader of Iraq for very long? And I don't mean because of the threats against his life, and there are many, but I mean as the voting begins.
Because Alawi's become so closely identified with the Bush administration, the level of popular support for him is decreasing dramatically, particularly after this trip to Washington. He's a strong figure who is serving an important role at an extremely difficult time as interim prime minister. I don't think he has a political future because Iraqis want sovereignty and independence, and he's not perceived as being independent. The broader problem is that the Iraqi exiles, with whom the United States has worked over the years, don't have broad popular support among Iraqis. The groups that do tend to be more radical and extreme and Islamist in nature. If those groups emerge from elections in January and form a government, they're likely to draft a constitution that institutionalizes Sharia law. The Kurds, who are pro-Western and secular, have said that they would not be part of an Iraq which is Islamist in nature.
Mm-hmm.
When people talk about a civil war, I don't think it's so much a sectarian conflict between Arab Sunni and Arab Shia. I think it's really an ethnic-based conflict where the Kurds determine that there's no place for them in a radical, fundamentalist, extremist, Islamist republic.
Yeah. What has to happen, in your opinion?
It's essential that elections proceed apace for January.
But I just want to interrupt to say that even Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said yesterday after Mr. Alawi's speech that the elections aren't going to be perfect. They may proceed, but they won't proceed everywhere across Iraq.
The only way that elections can proceed in any way, shape, or form is for the UN to get on the ground, organize a census, help Iraqis develop the infrastructure to conduct a nationwide ballot. The latest Security Council resolution called for a dedicated protection force. No country has stepped forward, including the United States, to provide those troops. As a result, there are only 30 UN personnel that are responsible for organizing 25,000 polling stations. That's simply not going to happen. If elections are going to go forward around the country, there needs to be a much more vigorous UN participation. The idea that we're going to go into Fallujah or Ramadi or anywhere in the Sunni Triangle and have credible elections is really far-fetched. The answer to that, in the mind of the Bush administration, is this proportional representation. Therefore, they think that that'll allow broader representation, even for groups that don't fully participate in the actual conduct of the ballot. If the election isn't seen as legitimate in the eyes of Iraqis, it's going to spark greater violence. And if the elections proceed and Islamists win, that could be the root of much greater ethnic conflict, particularly between Arabs and Kurds. So right now, things aren't looking good when it comes to Iraq's democratization.
David Phillips is a scholar at Harvard University's Center for Middle East Studies, an expert on the region that we're discussing. And David, while we have you, we wanted to speak to you yesterday about Mr. Alawi's speech, but you are on your way to lunch with Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf. Did President Musharraf say anything to you, first of all, about Alawi's speech and Alawi's assessment of what's happening in Iraq, or about whether or not Pakistan might one day send troops to Iraq?
Both Musharraf and Alawi talk about the root causes of terror, which are inequities and injustices. They both talk about the need for greater economic opportunity and educational opportunity at the same time as you confront terrorists militarily. The problem is that both of them are tilting towards the security strategy as opposed to the social and economic development end of things. There's no way that you can kill or capture every terrorist. The way that you drain the swamp is by dealing with the root causes. Both gentlemen talk a good game, but they haven't fulfilled their pledges to deal with the causes of terrorism by addressing some of the inequities that exist in their societies.
Pakistani forces have gone into the mountains on the border where Osama bin Laden is thought to be. Did President Musharraf say anything to you about bin Laden, who is supposed to be, you know, right in his backyard?
He describes efforts by Pakistan's military to hunt down bin Laden and other al-Qaeda operatives. The subtext to that is that there are elements within Pakistan's military and its intelligence services that have long-standing ties to the Taliban and ostensibly to al-Qaeda. So how authoritative Musharraf is in asserting his military efforts raises some real questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
David Phillips is a senior fellow and deputy director of the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air your thoughts. Terry Griffith of Mooresville, Pennsylvania wrote, after our interview with Carlton Sherwood, producer of Stolen Honor, the film critical of John Kerry's record in Vietnam. Terry writes, Kerry never tarred all Vietnam vets. His aim was the leaders that put them all in the same nasty boat of kill or be killed. Why are you not asking if the filmmaker denies the existence of My Lai, where U.S. soldiers indisputably killed hundreds of innocents? Ask about free fire zones, where all civilians were fair game. We lost that war because such events continually created more political support for the communists, just as the events in Iraq are continually creating more enemies. And it's not because the soldiers, for the most part, aren't fighting bravely. You don't help by throwing softballs to those who are trying to rewrite history. Well, Melissa Holtke of Woodstown, New Jersey, also wrote, after our story on the Columbus Washboard Company of Logan, Ohio, which is finding a new customer for their outdated devices, soldiers in Iraq. Melissa writes, I sent an email to the Department of Defense about your wonderful story on washboards, along with a link to the story so they could hear it themselves. I find it amazing that soldiers are ordering these items themselves. Shouldn't they be standard issue? Edward Wayland of Boston wrote, after our segment that referred to conservative talk radio, Edward writes, I recently read Al Gore referred to most conservative talk show hosts as digital brown shirts. I thought that was funny at the time, but not after listening to your interview with one of them today. His contempt for what he called the mainstream media was contempt for journalism itself. Journalism, as you tried to point out, is about viewing the statements of the government critically. It's done in the service of citizenship, which has, I think, similar obligations. Your guest was unashamed to express contempt for it. His show, he said, was the antidote. He and his message are a first step towards fascism. Our series by reporter Sean Cole on the faith-based abstinence program, The Silver Ring Thing, where a teenager takes a pledge to wear a ring and abstain from sex until marriage, brought this phone call.
Hi, my name is Brian Young, and I'm calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. At the very end of the Silver Ring Thing article, one of the people of the Silver Ring Thing said they didn't want to talk about condoms because kids will get all that information in their public schools. And I think, for me personally, one of the most disturbing aspects of the abstinence-only movement is the fact that they are lobbying to eliminate the teaching of condoms in schools, or they're only being allowed to teach the failure rate of the condoms, which is almost worse than not teaching them about condoms at all.
And finally, Rosie Vogel of Tucson, Arizona, wrote, after our piece on new technology for the disabled, Rosie writes, I'm a student in the Severe and Profound Disabilities Program at the University of Arizona. Your show on the so-called Freedom Machines was very informative and reassures me I made the right decision being in the special ed field. Thanks. Well, thank you. As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. And this update for you, like a fighter making a comeback, Hurricane Ivan circled back into the eastern U.S. today to try and land another punch, but forecasters say it delivered a relatively feeble one, with plenty of rain but little wind along the Texas-Louisiana line. Meanwhile, Hurricane Jean might step into the ring this weekend and pummel parts of central Florida, the fourth bout with a hurricane for Floridians this season. Jean has already been blamed for at least 1,100 deaths in Haiti. In anticipation of her arrival, parts of the east coast of Florida are already under a hurricane watch, and the Kennedy Space Center is closed to non-essential personnel. Meanwhile, waiting in the wings, Hurricane Carl, which is still out over the ocean, and Tropical Depression Lisa, far out in the Atlantic. The hurricane season formally ends November 30th, not a moment too soon for those in the storm's paths this year. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Crowds have been flocking to the Jimmy Tingle Theater in Somerville, Massachusetts recently to see the one-woman show Rebel Without a Pause, the stream-of-consciousness retelling of the days after 9/11 from a woman who was there, Reno.
Reno, we're under terrorist attack in Manhattan.
The show begins the way that day began, with a voicemail from one of Reno's many friends calling to alert this well-known New York club performer that something was happening at the buildings practically right across the street from her.
I've been underneath the World Trade. I'm not a World Trade Center kind of gal, you see what I'm saying? Not really a tall building, what do you call them, skyscraper kind of person.
Then suddenly the New York attitude, the sneer, are gone. Her face floods with feeling. And in a moment that will be repeated throughout the night, Reno is back in that day, and she turns and looks to where the Twin Towers are supposed to be.
So I go out, and, you know, there's like 60 or 70 of my neighbors, and we're all like, you know, standing, watching. You know, you wanted them to say, oh, no, it's just a stunt. It's David Copperfield. Oh, what a talented guy, isn't he? Oh, he can just...
For the next 2 hours, Karen Reno and her audience ricochet from tears to hilarity, from the pain of 9/11 to her fury over the war in Iraq. She talks about being a lesbian, being adopted, being American. It's exhilarating, exhausting, and hard to talk about, as I found when we spoke with Reno after a recent sold-out show.
What happens to you when you go back to that day?
You know, I guess there's a big part of me that wishes that I could, just now when you asked me, it's that way with time and events, period. You know, they just keep steamrolling ahead, and you've got to just grab a stick and flow with it somehow and not get crushed.
But I started to have all these conflicting feelings. I was noticing myself, like, I never thought I would feel tender feelings when hearing the word Pentagon, for example.
Is that the only way, maybe, even to talk about that day? I was wondering if that reflected...
Yeah, maybe it's, like, too much to hold on to the hard stuff for very long. I mean, it's sort of like a microcosm of just the way I've lived my life. I mean... You know, if I didn't have, a silly side, I'd probably be, in prison or in a mental hospital or something, you know, because I go off in a tangent that's funny, but people don't lose, I think, the seriousness.
Ashcroft, not only is he appointee of an appointed president, but this is a guy, when he last ran for election, he was an incumbent, which meant he had the job already. And during the campaign, you heard about this, his opponent died, and people in Missouri so didn't want him to be making any decisions for the public that they all voted for the dead guy. Oh, okay.
But you go off on these unbelievable tangents. They include how collies look like flounders because their eyes are on either side, and, you know, we're all laughing. And then you come back, and you're standing at the base of the World Trade Towers at your home. My heart breaks, and it looks as if yours still does, too.
Well, you know, I don't think we needed to get to this point, and it's really discouraging.
You talk in the show about, in ways, too, that seem emotional for you, about what it means to you to be an American.
Yeah, I mean, I think about that all the time, how enormously lucky I was not born in Sweden. No, just kidding. I was not born in Turkey, or certainly Colombia, pretty much anywhere else. I was adopted by WASPs, but I'm Cuban and Puerto Rican. You know, I was immediately literally bouncing off the walls. And, you know, would I have the same kind of personality if I didn't grow up in a democracy? Would I be also somebody who just couldn't keep their mouth shut when I saw, you know, when I felt cognitively dissonant with, you know, what we were taught versus what I see happening, you know, vis-a-vis freedom of speech or what have you? And I would always, since I'm a little kid, you know, scream about it. Well, you know, if I were brought up in a more closed society, I just probably wouldn't have been able to say as much. Like, you know, I was invited to perform in Cuba. I would have to preface the entire thing with the fact that the only, you know, if I was Cuban living in Cuba, I don't think I could be doing a show like this.
And they would have to know also that even though you're very angry, you cry when you hear God Bless America. Were you welling up?
Of course, yeah. Mm-hmm. Nobody? I'm the only schmuck? I'm up here telling what I'm telling. And it nobody in this bullshit. I mean, I cry because, I like I say in the show, it's just unconscionable to me, and I don't believe that it's happening, that we would give up, you know, the best deal in town, you know, shackle ourselves, you know, the Patriot Act, going against the Geneva Conventions, and... Well, I mean, becoming a Christian nation, we really have to, take to the streets on that. Creationist theory of how the Grand Canyon was created is actually for sale in our United States Parks Department bookstore at the Grand Canyon.
I even considered going out and buying a flag for a second. And of course, people in the rest of the country already own flags. Yeah, Martha, go in the kitchen. Get the big one. Get the 46 striper.
At the end of the show we attended, Reno handed out flyers for America Coming Together, or ACT, a grassroots push to get out the Democratic vote. She told the audience she understands their fear of approaching a stranger to talk politics. She's been there, joining others in 1976 to fight a California initiative to ban gay teachers.
It was so embarrassing. There I was at the Full Moon Bay Pumpkin Festival, and it's all families, you know, and I was, hi, I'm a lesbian. And, yeah, you're a lesbian, uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, no, I'm in theater too, but that's thespian, thank you. And I, you know, and I would have to, and we won. We got.
I was struck by how it sounded to me as if you started the show with this feeling of helplessness, like you're a doer, and so I'm going to fix this and I'm going to change this reality that's unfolding in front of you, and you can't. And you end the show, a fixer and a doer, and you're going to change this reality.
Well, I mean, it's not just me alone. I mean, I think that we have to, get beyond whatever would hold us back, such as talking to people who you don't know, and, this is a time when we have to, desperate measures are called for because it's desperate times. You know, I frankly am enlivened by the whole thing.
New York comic Reno. For more on her tour, check out our website, here-now.org.
my home, sweet home.
And as Reno points out, she's Canadian. Celine Dion, that is. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.